Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we meet legendary Wisconsin actor Alfred Lunt.
First, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced this week that it's going to impose its own rules on Wisconsin if the state's Department of Natural Resources doesn't submit regulations on fine air pollution within the next 2 years.
The state DNR has missed the submission deadline by over 2 years. They were supposed to have the new regulations in place by June 2012. The kind of pollution under consideration is linked to diseases like asthma and bronchitis.
George Meyer joins us now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former secretary of the state's DNR. George, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be on the show.
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has issued a finding of failure to Wisconsin when it comes to limiting fine particle pollution. How significant is this?
Well, this is very, very unusual. In fact, it may be very unprecedented in terms of the Department of Natural Resources, many programs that are based on federal law. And the fact that this was not undertaken within the deadline is, and thereby EPA stating that it's going to issue its own rules, is very significant. And actually shows that priorities are not being followed at DNR to protect the environment.
Has Wisconsin ever gotten a warning like this before?
Not of this nature at all. And, in fact, that's what is as concerning about this as the issue that's involved, which is a public health issue. But the fact that the department did not adopt rules as they were required to by federal law within the time frame. They were asked to do this back in 2010. The deadline was in 2012. And they're just, you know, in 2014, the EPA said, that's enough. We're going to adopt rules within 2 more years.
Can you break this down a little for us? What exactly was Wisconsin supposed to provide rules for, and what did it fail in doing?
Okay, the specific rule in case is an air pollution rule, and it deals with those, what it's called major sources, which are the larger emitting facilities in the state. Things like power plants is an example. It's probably the best example. And this particular standard is for what's called fine particulates or soot, and it's the small – this – particular regulation deals with the more fine, the smaller pieces of material, particulates. But in fact, these are the most serious in terms of health. These get deep into your lungs, and it's associated. The reason the regulations are in place are for asthma, emphysema, this type of thing. And the standards are to be put in place so that when DNR issues its permits to these facilities, those power plants, as an example, would have to put on treatment to prevent this from getting into the air and into the neighborhoods where these facilities are. So this isn't just a paper kind of problem. There is a health concern associated by not going forward with these standards in a timely manner.
So the state was supposed to have submitted plans addressing these fine particles to the EPA back in June of 2012. Do you know what held things up?
Well, you know, according to that, they were waiting for some other federal lawsuit to be done so they could, not involving the department, but they and they wanted to see how that went or whatever. And I think other people have commented on this. They should have clearly gone forward and carried out their responsibility. The lawsuit did not involve the state of Wisconsin. There was a deadline. Other states met the deadline. I think, you know, maybe a couple other states in the whole country didn't. but Wisconsin decided not to go forward at that time.
Now, as I understand it, the DNR is also saying they've had staffing shortages. They were waiting for the resolution of these lawsuits. Does that rationale, does that explanation hold up for you?
Well, they go forward with other rules and other work. Waiting for the lawsuit, I don't think was a very appropriate reason. And you know, if they were even close to having the rule in place, you know, let's say they couldn't start it immediately, if they had shown tremendous progress, I suspect EPA would not have done what they've done. But obviously, it's 2 years past the deadline. I mean, this requirement went in effect they were asked to do this starting in 2010. And they're just starting the rulemaking process in 2014. You can have staff shortages, but eventually you need, especially when it comes to a public health regulation, you need to be doing these things quicker. And, you know, EPA made that decision also, that they, in fact, filed this notice that they're going to adopt rules.
Now, you're a former secretary of the DNR. Do you see changes in how the department's being run, especially when it comes to emissions?
There clearly is a reduction in the, as example, in the amount of enforcement and in inspections of facilities, which are very important. I mean, you can have all the best regulations in the world, but if you're not having timely inspections to see if facilities comply or enforcement, in fact, there was just a case, a water pollution case in I believe it was Wood County or Marathon County, where 600,000 gallons of manure was discharged over a period of a year. And no inspection was done, and it wasn't caught. The facility didn't look for it. The DNR didn't look for it. And it ended up getting a wetland into one of our rivers and went into the headwaters of a flowage, which is highly eutrophic because of too much nutrients. Now, those types of things need to be caught. And even when caught, there was a very small fine, $460 or something. There just seems to be more emphasis in getting the permits out the door rather than enforcing and inspecting and getting getting the standards into effect.
How serious is the issue of putting caps on small particle pollution here in Wisconsin particularly?
Well, these deal with the major power plants in the state, which are the larger emitters of pollutants. And as I mentioned, these small micron, the technical standard is the particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns, are significant health hazards. This is the dust that gets into your lungs. And because it's small, it can get deep into the lungs. So this is not an insignificant standard.
Now, a spokesperson for the DNR said that this small particle rule that is missing from Wisconsin is only a small part of Wisconsin's plan for the Clean Air Act and that everything else has been accounted for. So given that context, do you still see this as something that's significant, or is this maybe understandable when you're looking at a big thing like the Clean Air Act?
Well, there are other standards, but, you know, going back over the years since the Clean Air Act was passed, you know, this is highly unusual, if not unprecedented, that Wisconsin didn't comply with the law. It just shows a more lax system than there used to be. That this should have been a priority, especially because of the health concerns.
Do you think that the EPA will actually have to get involved here and impose its own rules, or do you think the DNR will get it together and get these rules out to them in a timely fashion?
Well, both the EPA and Wisconsin probably will start the rulemaking process. And it's indicated DNR is now going to start, but if they don't complete it within 2 years, EPA has to have their regulation in place within 2 years. So then 2 years, there will be a regulation, whether it's federal or state. But clearly, now we have two different agencies having to go through this process.
And do you expect that these new rules, whether they come from the EPA or from the DNR, do you expect them to be stricter than the ones that we have now?
I do, yes.
Well, George, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
That was George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former Secretary of the Wisconsin DNR. The U.S. EPA announced this week that it is going to impose its own rules on Wisconsin if the state's DNR doesn't take action on fine particle air pollution in the next 2 years.
In this edition of Curious Wisconsin, we take a look at a Wisconsin legend of the theater, Alfred Lunt, born this week in 1892.
Director and critic Harold Clurman said of Lunt that he was, quote, universally acclaimed the finest American actor in the generation which followed John Barrymore. He was talking about Milwaukee-born Alfred Lunt, who, with his wife Lynn Fontanne, were a major force in American theater for 40 years. We'll find out about Alfred Lunt from Randy Bryant, president and CEO of the Ten Chimneys Foundation in Genesee Depot. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well,
Randy, give us the basics. Who were Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne?
Well, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, they were the premier stage actors from the 1920s through the 1960s, and they were perfectionists at its best.
And how did Wisconsin shape Alfred Lunt as a person, as an actor?
Well, Alfred was born and raised in Wisconsin, and his father died at an early age, so he really became the man of the house, taking care of things, highly devoted to his mother, Hattie. But when you think of how Wisconsin shaped him, he went to Carroll College, and it was there at Carroll College that he was encouraged to go off to Boston and to stay in theater.
And you said they were perfectionists. How did that come into play in their theater career?
Oh, they were relentless. They loved playing in front of an audience, and so therefore they made sure that it was done perfect before they actually got on stage.
And they were on Broadway, their big claim to fame?
They were on Broadway, but they played all over the country, and that's really what attributes to their success, the fact that they played everywhere. And so they felt that everyone deserved to have quality, good theater. And so they played in the smallest places. They played in even churches. But they made sure that they continued to act and continued to deliver quality theater throughout the country.
You mentioned they loved being up in front of a live audience. I understand that while they were in some films, that wasn't their priority. Why did they go for the theater more than the screen?
Well, again, being perfectionists, and they really want to have the artistic control. Hmm. And so back in those days, it was not heard of to provide artistic control. Today, you see some actors get that, but it was unheard of back then. But the other thing is that they really love responding to a live audience and the response they receive from a live audience. And so they didn't like just doing a take and then taking and having someone else decide, okay, it's done. Hmm. They felt that it's done when we say it's done.
What roles do we know them best for today?
Well, in Design for Living, you know them in, I know this one by heart. In Design for Living, they played Gilda and Otto. And then in The Taming of the Shrew, it was Kate and Petruchio.
Uh-huh.
But their one and single and only film was The Guardsman. Started out as a play that they did in 1924, and then it was done for MGM in 1931. And so that's their one and only movie that they did together.
And their national reputation in the theater world, were they regarded as top-flight performers?
They were the best. As I stated earlier, they were the premier actors, and they developed the method acting that you see today.
Really?
Never before did actors turn their back on an audience. That was never thought of. And Alfred turned his back on the audience, and they had actual conversations. They spoke over one another, which is the way people speak. Naturally, but back in those days, you would say your line, and then you wait, and then the other person would respond, and that was not natural for them. The other reason why they really gained attraction by the audience is that being married, they were able to do a little bit more than your average stage actors could do. So, and they took it to the limits.
Didn't I read that they were in something a little risque that involved a menage a trois? Speaking of.
Well, it may have been called a menage a trois back then. I think today we would have trouble seeing what's wrong with it. But, yeah, it was. But actually, the menage a trois made it quite popular. I mean, it's the ticket prices were going for way over list price. And it sold out for every performance. And basically it stopped after 6 months because Noel Coward got tired. He just didn't want to continue on. But it could have gone on forever because there were crowds and crowds of people that were there, and they even had to have the police control some of the crowds at times.
Were they always performing together, or did they do a lot of work on their own as well?
No. They made a contract. One of the reasons why they went with the theater guild was that they were able to agree that they would only act together, and they would be able to have their summers off to be able to spend out at Ten Chimneys. Mm. And so there's an exception. In 1927, Lynn made a film, I think it was Strange Interludes, by Eugene O'Neill. But other than that, they acted together. And this started early on. If you consider that they met in 1919, married in 1922, and in 1924 is when they joined the theater guild, and that's when they made their pact. So that's why you don't see them separate.
Huh.
Sounds like quite a love story when you compare it to, you know, the Hollywood romances of today. They really seem to have been in love with each other. And they weren't just icons of theater, it sounds like. They were also known for having incredible elegance and grace, weren't they?
Incredible elegance and grace, but also just being incredible people. You know, when you look at their core values in terms of what they value lasting relationships. And they had many relationships with many people. And so, and when you think of the secrets that were kept, coming out to Ten Chimneys in Genesee Depot, first of all, you have to think Genesee Depot, little Genesee Depot. And then you think of the big stars that were out there. So Laurence Olivier, Katharine Hepburn, I'm losing some of the thoughts there. I can see his face, Montgomery Clift. Mm. But all of them were coming out to Genesee Depot. And at that time, it was not known. But yet they would come out there and they would spend months at a time. Helen Hayes would spend months at a time out there. And they would enjoy themselves. Nothing was said by the town. The lunch did not broadcast, oh, we have these people coming out or whatever. But the relationships lasted a lifetime. And we still have people coming to Ten Chimneys sharing stories about Alfred and Lynn and just how giving, how kind they were. And so what we emulate at Ten Chimneys is all a reflection of what their lives have been.
Well, take us to their home at Ten Chimneys. What's it like?
It is amazing. It is a place where one can go to escape. Ten Chimneys is really multifaceted because when you go there in the main house, it's like going into a set. It was designed, many of the murals there, many of the murals were designed by Claggett Wilson, who was a set designer. And but the house is very whimsical. It's a lot of fun. And it is a stage. And it's as if you're walking to stage. The studio where they practiced their lines and acted and where they would dance is a wonderful place. And then you have the cottage, which is Scandinavian as a result of Alfred's roots. But foremost, it's just a place to relax. The pool, one of the first pools one of the first in-ground pools in the state of Wisconsin, one of the largest pools. And then you have to remember, it was a gentleman's farm. And so a reflection of all of what Alfred and Lynn enjoyed. Alfred was a cordon bleu cook, and so he would take from his gardens. And Ten Chimneys, we're proud to say that we have continued that on. And so we give, with the vegetables that we raise, we give to the food pantries in both Waukesha and Milwaukee County. The eggs that we raise, we also pass those on. So it's really nice. We have the aroma of the farm there. But yet at the same time, we have the setting, which is so great, so elegant, and so exceptional, which we open once a year to the public where they can come have all access to all the buildings and all the grounds. If you want to have a picnic there, come out and have a picnic at Ten Chimneys.
Well, speaking of a picnic, real quick, in the next 20 seconds or so, if someone wants to visit, what do they do?
If you want to visit, just call in to our line, 262-968-4100, and you get the reservationist, make your reservation, and come on out to Ten Chimneys.
All right, Randy, thanks so much for coming to visit us today.
Thank you.
That's Randy Bryant. He is president and CEO of the Ten Chimneys Foundation. Our next guest says the economy is going through a fundamental change. A record number of millennials are choosing to join tech startups, start small local businesses, or freelance instead of following a more conventional career path.
There are now more programs to share cars, bikes, and even homes. Handcrafted goods are now all the rage, and people are selling them in the ever-growing online marketplace.
Our next guest looked at those and other data points and trends and says they're part of a huge economic shift to the purpose economy. Aaron Hurst is the author of the new book of that name, The Purpose Economy, How Your Desire for Impact, Personal Growth, and Community is Changing the World. He's also the CEO of Imperative and the founder and advisor to the Taproot Foundation. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Excited to be with you.
Now, before we dive into the purpose economy, we commonly call our current era the information economy. And your idea here, your project started when you were reviewing your uncle's work, kind of coining the idea of the information economy. How has our economy been evolving since then?
Yeah, no, absolutely. He was an economist at Stanford and coined the term and proved that it had become the dominant driver of the economy. And, you know, it was the third. It was after the agrarian and industrial economy. And it's been changing pretty radically over the last 10 years as especially the millennial generation has entered the workforce and is starting to demand very different things from their careers and also demand very different things from the companies that are selling them goods, services, and experiences.
Let's get into this idea of purpose. And you point out that a lot of people might think purpose is the same as a cause. I am going to leave my job and go change the world somewhere. You have a more nuanced idea, a more personal idea of what purpose is. What is it?
Yeah, it's really based on science. So it's not so much my idea. The science actually shows that purpose and cause are not the same thing. There's a lot of people with causes with no purpose and a lot of people who work with purpose with no cause. We need to get beyond that and realize that purpose is about the relationships with others. It's about doing something greater than yourself, and it's about personal growth. Those are the things that scientifically generate a sense of purpose for us at work, but also as members of the community.
And that's becoming more important to us now.
Yeah, the millennial generation puts purpose as their top priority in defining success in their career and is making constant decisions based on optimizing against those three variables. And you're also seeing women are much more prone to prioritizing those three things that define purpose, and they obviously are, you know, increasingly the leadership of companies and organizations and building organizations based on that.
Can you give us a few examples of how, let's start with those millennials you're talking about, of how they're putting purpose into practice in their work lives?
Yeah, I mean, so one great example, I mean, traditional model was you should spend the first third of your life learning, then a third earning, and then returning. It's a learn, earn, return model, right? And that was sort of how you divided your career. What millennials are saying is, I want to learn, earn, and return every month, every week, every year, right? And they're constantly doing sort of extracurricular learning. They're doing extracurricular impact. They're looking for jobs that are around impact. They're really building portfolios of work and learning and returning all at once in a way in which no generation has really done at that scale before.
So the kinds of things, what kind of job or what kind of practice might they do to merge those three things together?
Yeah, a lot of it just has to start to do with starting with self-awareness and understanding what generates purpose for them, and then just whatever the job is, and it really doesn't matter what the job is, looking for opportunities to boost relationships, boosting their ability to make an impact and growth, and doing that by learning, earning, and returning at the same time. So it's just understanding in your work how to constantly be looking for learning opportunities, how to constantly be looking for ways to grow, ways to help others. It's basic but fundamental.
And you see the internet in part as a precondition, an infrastructure for this kind of shift. How has the way we use and think of the internet changed and merged with this idea of purpose?
Yeah, it's really made this ability to have a portfolio career possible for a lot of folks because they're able to have the flexibility. They're not tied to a given location. They're able to participate in other activities outside of work in ways they couldn't before. And they're also able to access technology that's helping them build self-awareness, like our site, imperative.com, where you can determine what drives purpose for you. What are your psychological purpose drivers? And it takes like 15 minutes, and they can do what traditionally would have taken, you know, several months with an executive coach to do. And that's because of technology and what it's enabled professionals to access.
Now, you've pointed toward millennials as a big driver of the changes you're looking at, but you don't exclude this to millennials. You talk about baby boomers in large part as they start second act or late career changes. In some ways, they're going through this in similar ways to millennials.
No, that's exactly right. They're sort of going back to their values when they were graduating from college, and as they're entering sort of later stage of their life, they're saying, I'm going to be around for a while, and I want to do work that matters. I'm not done learning. They're also, unfortunately, due to economics, not done earning. So they really are trying to, again, bring all these three things together, and they're, you know, looking for jobs. My dad, you know, at close to 70, just became a social entrepreneur for the first time. I mean, people are really in that generation, redefining their careers and trying to do something that'll, you know, last them as they live into their 90s and beyond.
You look at a lot of this as a positive change, but you just mentioned some baby boomers are needing to do this for financial reasons. And at the millennial end, sometimes that, you know, lucrative career path just isn't there, and it's more a matter of cobbling together as best they can. Is there a negative side to this too, or at least at best a virtue out of necessity?
Well, I mean, I think purpose in of itself is not a good thing. It's what you do with it. I think in terms of the issue around work, I think what a lot of millennials are realizing is they can't have that career path that previous generations did, and they're realizing that's not how they're going to get satisfaction, just through making money. And it's causing them to reflect and become more self-aware, and then they're realizing, you know what, that doesn't even lead to happiness or well-being. It turns out actually what I care about are these other qualities in my life. So I think it's less out of necessity as it is it created a condition in which they had to be more self-aware and redefine success.
And you write that you can find purpose in any line of work. How is that possible? How can any job be have purpose added to it?
Yeah, that is sort of a shocking thing for me to realize as well as I looked at the research, which basically there's three ways people look at work. Some people see it as just a job. Some see it as part of their ego and identity, which is part of what we call a career. And some people think of it as a calling, where they actually see work itself as adding value to the world. And what they found is that across every profession they studied, a third of people were in each of those categories. So a third of doctors just see their work as a job, a third see it as a career, and some see it as a calling. So there's no work that in and of itself is more purposeful than others. It's really what you bring to it. And
Aaron, are you still there? We've lost Aaron for a moment. In the meantime, I'll invite you to call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your work, your career? Have you found purpose in the work that you do? Or maybe you need some advice on figuring out what the purpose is and what you're doing, whether you need a career change or a new path. Are you one of these millennial freelancers that he's talking about? Are you cobbling together meaning in your own way? Call in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our conversation now with entrepreneur Aaron Hurst about his new book, The Purpose Economy.
And you can join in the conversation. Are you a baby boomer starting a second career? What are you looking for? Are you looking for meaning, to make a difference, to change your life in some ways? Are you a Generation Xer or a millennial looking for a different kind of work, for purpose in what you do? What does it mean to find purpose in the work you do? Does it matter what the work is, or can you make that meaning yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Aaron, you point toward three different kinds of purpose and meaning in work. I think it was personal, social, and social good. Could you talk about those three different types of purpose?
Yeah, so some people really get a lot of purpose out of working with individuals. Some people get it from working with groups and organizations, and some get it more from working at a societal or policy level. So if you think about healthcare, for example, some people get tremendous purpose being a doctor, some out of being a hospital administrator, and others from working in healthcare policy. And they're all in healthcare, but they all are radically different jobs, and a lot of doctors would never get purpose being a hospital administrator, But many hospital administrators would never get much purpose being a doctor. And it's really key that you start to understand for yourself what drives purpose for you so you can do the kind of work that's best optimized to your type of purpose.
Right. So is the best answer, if you don't feel the purpose, to try to change the way you think about the job you're in, love the one you're with, I guess, or try to figure out what would satisfy your sense of purpose and try to work out of your current job and get into something else?
I mean, it's really specific to your own situation, the risk that you're able to take. In general, our point of view, which a mentor shared with me, was the grass isn't greener on the other side. It's greenest where you fertilize it, right? And I think you should always look first to say, how can I optimize the current role I'm in? How can I rethink about the impact I'm having, the relationships, on how I'm able to grow here? But if you feel like fundamentally you've hit a wall and there's nowhere to go there, or the organization doesn't share your values, or you have a manager that fundamentally stands in your way, you may need to find another solution.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Daryl on the line in Lancaster. Daryl, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've been working on this for many decades now, and we need to pursue a wisdom-based purpose in all of our communications and what we teach and what we do. And actually, we need a total cultural shift, because our mass media can do wonders for our economy and for the future. And with climate change, these climate extremes are going to be extremely costly. And if we don't all get on board and work together and really communicate in a mass media way, connected with the internet too, with videos and so forth, we're going to be too far behind, and we're going to lose the battle.
Interesting. Daryl, thanks for the call. He brings up a lot there. First of all, he says we need a major cultural shift. Aaron, if I read you right, we're having a major cultural shift, whether we want it or not.
No, it's absolutely happening. It's largely the millennial generation that's forcing this change. I mean, it doesn't mean it can't be stopped. It doesn't mean that it can't be diluted, but from what I'm seeing, it's a pretty strong movement. I mean, it's happening. It doesn't mean you're seeing it everywhere. We're still seeing media that's getting in the way. We're still seeing some business, some government that's getting in the way. But that's just part of the process of change. But I agree with Daryl. If we don't figure out how to live our values, lead our values, and govern with values, the future is not going to be too bright.
And speaking of that connection point and media, Daryl, talking about mass media there, you are, in, I think, Aaron, looking for more peer-to-peer communication, direct links, direct connections, and relationship building between people.
Yeah, we find that when people connect around shared purpose and what drives them, it's like an incredibly powerful bond, and it gives them the courage to really act and live and work with values. And we need to find ways to build those kinds of connections and not, some of the more superficial ones that, in recent years have brought us together.
Daryl, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jack and Viola. Jack, hi.
Hi. I was just driving home. I'm a social worker. I've been a therapist, for 11, 12 years, but now I'm working with treatment foster care. And I chose to be a social worker over making money as an engineer or a couple other things. And, I recommend people do what they want, and there's a lot of purpose in that, And 4 years from now, I'll probably retire with Social Security, work half-time, but I'm also a president of a nonprofit organization, and I'll put my time in doing that, and maybe I'll do seminars and teach from my experience from working social work, but I'm also interested in psychology and religion and human sexuality, so I can work and do community college type of stuff. So, I'm doing what I want. I don't make a lot of money, but I really enjoy it.
Jack, thank you so much. Sounds like he's an example of the purpose economy at work, Aaron.
Yeah, I love it. He sounds like he's a boomer that's living like a millennial. I love it.
Yeah,
and you're seeing more and more of that of people who are, there's actually an executive at LinkedIn recently who was one of the most successful execs, and he just demoted himself four levels. He's like, I actually enjoyed being on the front lines more than I do being an exec. I think people are starting to realize that life's short and you got to do what you love, because you don't bring that money with you.
That reminds me of another way you point toward of finding purpose, even if you don't have it necessarily in your workday. You talk about, instead of thinking about going out and volunteering, taking your skills, taking your abilities and knowledge and going out and doing pro bono work in your field, that does make a difference, that does satisfy that sense of purpose. Are we seeing more of that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what I spent the last 12 years doing, was building a movement to get
business professionals to donate their marketing, tech, HR, and other skills. And we built it out to about a $15 billion a year market, and then with global programs around the world. And it is so powerful. And it's what nonprofits need most is help with these business services. And yet most of what they get are people who come in and are just roll up their sleeves. And I really encourage all business professionals to think about how important those skills are that they have and make sure they're not just available to those that can afford them, but available to those who need them most.
Well, and you mentioned the example, I think, of maybe an ad copywriter. And if they want to make a difference, does it help more if they go out and volunteer to, you know, paint houses with a lack of skill or to write copy with their skills for a nonprofit they believe in?
No, and it's just, I mean, in pure economic terms, I mean, if they're just painting a fence, they're likely not doing a great job of it, and it's probably only worth $10 to $20 an hour. Whereas if they're using their skills, you're looking at something more like $40, $60, $80 an hour. So we're robbing nonprofits of impact when we're doing work that's beneath where our skills are at, when they actually need those skills most.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Clark on the line in West Bend. Clark, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Well, I tell you, the thing is, the thing I do now for work is helping handicapped people, handicapped people go to doctor's appointments and so forth. But you brought up the idea of doing what you love or doing what interests you because you have to do it. So I wrote a screenplay. I've been interested in films for years and years. Now, I don't think that the screenplay necessarily is going to change the world, but it is that thing that, you know, you say, well, time has come to do what I need to do to satisfy myself. And as long as it's not a selfish or destructive project, and I think a screenplay called Moment of Innocence is going to maybe fulfill my needs.
Clark, thank you so much for sharing that. And Aaron, I think that's something you talk about in the book as well. If we want to be creative, there are more and more platforms where we can share our creative output with the world, even if it's not part of our job, it's not what we're getting paid for.
Yeah, and Clark, it sounds like you're from my neck of the woods down in Brooklyn. I see. Hey, how you doing? So I don't know if you have Brooklyn roots, but yeah, that's absolutely right. I think it's two things. It's, you know, I think we need to treat all the work we do as if we're an artist, whether it's actual, you know, quote-unquote art or not. And the companies that are enabling people to do that are thriving. But it's also, as I listen to Clark, it's about doing new things and doing things that stretch us and maybe are a little uncomfortable. That gives you a sense of purpose. So writing a screenplay, if you've never done that before, trying something new is one of the best ways to get purpose. And it doesn't mean anyone's going to ever read it. It doesn't mean it's any good, but just trying, it makes us our lives bigger. It helps us grow.
Well, you mentioned companies enabling people to find their purpose. We've been focusing on the individual side so far. What can a company or an organization or a governmental bureau or whatever do to fire up that sense of purpose among the workers?
Yeah, so we work with a lot of companies around this, and there's a couple of things. The first thing is help employees become more self-aware about what actually drives purpose for them so they can be better advocates for themselves. So help them get access to resources like ours where you can start to diagnose what actually matters to me. And then really work to connect your organization's purpose. So like what's your mission as a company to the individual? So a lot of times companies just hand out laminated sheets that say, here's our mission statement, here are our values, but they don't connect that to you as a person. And helping people see how their purpose fits into the organization really builds up loyalty and engagement.
Well, Aaron, a spoiler alert. I read something in the conclusion to your book that speaks to your ultimate purpose here. You mentioned the Jewish concept, I'll butcher the pronunciation, Tikkun Olam, repair the world.
Yep.
How does that drive you?
Yeah, I love this. There's a similar, I was raised as a Buddhist and as a Jew, and it's there's similar philosophies in both, but it's repair the world is a wonderful idea because the core of it is, of course, just as one of your callers said, we've got to repair the world. There's so much that needs to get done, and we need to repair the world. But at the same time, in the statement itself, we'll never repair the world. It's too big of a task, right? But it's that ambition of trying to do something that isn't possible but is what needs to get done that keeps us going forward and driving. It drives progress and drives purpose.
So we can try to connect the dots in our little way in the relationships we build and the connections we make, the ways we make differences toward that bigger, overwhelming goal of repairing the world?
You got to start by repairing yourself. And you repair yourself by being self-aware, by recognizing who you are and your impact on your immediate surroundings, and you can grow from there. But if you don't first repair yourself, you'll never repair the world.
Well, we know what, you know, the industrial age looked like, the agricultural age looked like, our information economy looks like, still evolving, I think. Once we're through this shift, what does a purpose economy world look like?
Yes, we've been doing a lot of work around how our cities changing in this new economy. And I think a lot of it has to do with creating continuous education where it's a lifelong experience. It's about more and more integration and blurring of lines between things like education, work, retirement, in different communities. It's about fundamentally, as you shared in your intro, it's about being able to share resources and being able to have places together where we can craft together and work as artists. I mean, I could go on and on, but it's a lot like Brooklyn. And it's a lot like some of, like Madison, Wisconsin. It's places where you're already seeing these innovations emerge.
And is that, do you think, going to spread? Are we seeing islands of the purpose economy now, and we'll start to see it spread elsewhere?
Absolutely. I mean, you see little pockets everywhere. I mean, you see neighborhoods that are embracing this everywhere. And then they're slowly growing, and people are realizing that that's really the way they want to live, and they're finding ways to bring it to their communities.
So you've been working on this. So you've had this book project going for a while. You work on this on the websites and organizations you do. Is there something that's surprised you? Have you found new little ways to express your personal sense of purpose?
The biggest thing for me is less expressing it, more just appreciating it. And just getting in the ritual of, you know, stopping every hour or two and just saying, like, this is as good as it gets. And the people I'm around, what I'm doing right now, like, this is what life is. And letting go of the past and trying to let go of the future and just being really present. And it's remarkable how much that's just changed my well-being and my also the relationships I have at work and in my life. So that's been like the most wonderful gift of the last year or so, just doing this work.
Aaron, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Work with purpose, man.
That was Aaron Hurst. He's the author of The Purpose Economy, How Your Desire for Impact, Personal Growth, and Community is Changing the World.